21. Fragments. The Lady Lucia Gallica Tamarocca hides, though it is a poor form of hiding. The heavy drapes of the grand chamber have been closed, the last chore of her household staff before they fled. The room is gloomy, but for the lamp at her side. The Lady Lucia Gallica Tamarocca has put on her finest gown, with its vast train and skirts of lace and silk. She has put on her best powdered wig, and she has rouged her cheeks. This is how she would dress whenever she, along with the high-born scions of other noble houses, was summoned from her Palatine mansion to a formal event in the sanctum. The room trembles. She hears the windows shiver in their casements. The Lady Lucia Gallica Tamarocca watches her beloved songbirds flutter and chirp in the huge and ornate birdcage on the table in front of her. How unafraid they seem. The cage is too heavy for her to carry, for she is an old woman, and she would never have left them behind. She considered letting them go, setting them free, but like her, where would they fly to? The Lady Lucia Gallica Tamarocca has decided to stay, to hide in the curtained darkness until whatever finds her, finds her. She is too dignified to run. She is of noble blood, and this mansion is her family home. She will not be driven out of it by mindless curs, no matter how brutal they are. The room trembles. Dust drifts down from the ceiling. The Lady Lucia Gallica Tamarocca keeps her seat, despite the sounds that rise like a storm around her house. This is her home. She absolutely will not run. She is nobility, and nobility does not flee. And besides, who would feed her birds? She hears something scratching at the chamber door. They are here now. Very well. So be it. The Lady Lucia Gallica Tamarocca has a Laslock pistol in her lap. Face down, Sergeant Hettin Goltan of the Royal Zanzibari Horde hides among the dead by pretending to be one of them. The dead are his men, and mud clasps them all. The enemy approaches, stalking from the smoke. He hopes he will pass unnoticed, but he will not. The world-eaters smell fear, and the dead are no longer afraid. Barthuza Narek of the Word-Bearers stays hidden. Concealed in the rubble of a smashed fortification, he watches the cities of the human homeworld burn. The Word-Bearers who accompanied him to Terra and the final fight are dead. Most were killed when their dropship was hit by battery fire on the assault run. The rest he killed himself. Once on the burning fields of the throne world, one mote swept up on a war of global scale, he had no need to keep pretending he was one of them, or that he shared their manic ambitions. There's only one death, one end that interests him. He's tracking his prey. Hidden, invisible, he scopes from the rubble with his sniper rifle. He has standard ammunition left, and he'll use that as he pleases. He has one fulgurite bullet remaining too, and he's saving it. When he finally locates his father, Lorgar, he will load it and use it. There is nowhere to hide. Something down the street, a traitor engine by the sound of it, is raking Kucha's position with some kind of cutting beam, some hideous area denial weapon. The beam, scarcely thicker than a whisker, is only visible when it passes through smoke. It cuts through everything it touches like a hot wire. It cuts through brick, stone, metal and armour. It cuts through Kucha's men. He sees it slice the corners off buildings, cleanly sectioning stonework like soft cheese. He sees it prune light poles and drop them like logs. He sees it pass like a flawless surgical blade through the tops of helmets, through torsos, through limbs. The corpses of 9 men are already piled on the pavement, cut into astonishingly geometric cross-sections. There is so much blood. Kucha yells at his squad to move and find cover, but there is absolutely nowhere to hide. Sergeant Gira falls, precisely severed at the waist. Trooper Vaskol loses both legs at the knees and collapses like a bolster. Trooper Hirsch leans against a wall, and then half of him slides away vertically in a sudden outwelling of blood that leaves the rest of him propped up like a dissection plate in a Medicaid treatise. Kucha hurls himself into cover behind the command aurochs. He feels the vehicle shudder slightly and sees a meticulous hairline crack suddenly running along the hull, end to end at chest height. Kucha smells burned meat and the coppery stink of blood. He looks down at himself as he falls apart. The Skitarii, vassals of the Dark Mechanicum, think they are well hidden. They have clambered up the flying buttresses of the shell-struck manufactory and gained access to the lowest tier of the flat roofing. They move in fire teams, lugging the disassembled parts of three heavy fusion mortars between them. Torrential rain pelts down across the roofscape, and vapor swirls up from the galvanized panels of the flat roof. The Skitarii flash encrypted Binharic data bursts to and fro. On the next level up, they will unpack their cargo and assemble the mortars for firing, dropping a string of fusion bombs on the unsuspecting loyalist forces dug in behind the manufactory's eastern wall. The Skitarii are from the Kal-Tag Delt sub-branch, a purpose-specific clade designed for line infiltration and group-unified by stealth-adaptive coding. Their power sources are baffled to mask heat profile, and their motivators frictionless and damped. Despite the weapons and munition canisters they carry, they move in virtual silence. Their body armor, layers of long ceramite leaf panels that encase them like feathers, is matte gray and non-reflective. They are virtually invisible to Auspex and Modar. Their optics and sensoria are particularly large and sensitive. Nevertheless, there is someone waiting for them on the flat roof. He is crouched in the rain, a sword flat across his knees. The Skitarii register surprise code. They were hiding, concealed. How did the Astartes legionary hide, conceal himself from their hiding concealment? How did he get there without detection to be hiding, waiting for them? Their Binharic queries go unanswered. Loken rises to his feet, chainsword purring as he extends it out to his right. He draws Rubio's blade in his left hand. The Kal-Tag Delt register no fear. Fear is not a coded option for them. They set down the mortar components and rush him. They have calculated the variables. They are many, and he is... into them without hesitation. Blades loop and hiss in the rain, shredding armor, leaves, and plastic, spraying debris and severed limbs into the air. They stab at him, they shoot, but he is moving too fast, and he is in among them, impaling and carving, smashing one Skitarius into another with crushing force. Rubio's blade smokes with angry power as it slices through tubing, through wiring plaits, through mechadendrites, through torso plate, through helmets surgically fused to skulls. Ascatarius folds under the fury of Loken's chainsword like torn foil. Broken leaves spin up from the impact. Loken turns and rakes Rubio's blade through the thorax of a particularly large Mechanicum warrior. Its chest explodes in sparks and fragments of circuitry. As it teeters, systems ruined, he delivers a hard kick to its belly that smashes it off the edge of the flat roof and knocks three others of its kind off the lip with it. The remainder scuttle back from him, fast processing the conclusion that he is an unexpectedly dangerous impediment. One flash burns out a nospheric signal, calling in immediate fire support with no heed for the integrity of itself or the surviving members of its unit. Such is the pragmatic war logic of the Skitarii. This impediment is too dangerous and must be obliterated as a priority. 1.5 seconds later, an auto-slaved launcher unit, three streets away, fires a hunter-seeker missile vertically with a sucking roar of firewash. The missile climbs on a tail of blue flame, arcs and plunges. Loken sees the twinkle of it and leaps. The entire flat roof annihilates as it impacts, and two of the great stone buttresses collapse, folding like weary limbs. In the courtyard below, Loken rises to his feet. The flagstones under his boots are cracked from his sure-footed landing. Cinders flutter down around him in the rain. He glances up at the burning rooftop he has just vacated. The flames swirling off it are almost incandescent. He sheathes Rubio's blade, then uses the tip of his chainsword to probe the broken bodies of the four Skitarii he kicked off the roof. They are smashed and crumpled on the yard's flagstones around him. One stirs and starts to gurgle out some kind of reboot code. Loken applies a little pressure and lets the chainsword saw its head off. He takes stock. He was sure he'd just heard someone call his name again. The yard, mysteriously, seems familiar. Rain sheets down. An abandoned ground car stands off to one side. The flagstones are littered with broken glass and lumps of burning debris from the destroyed roof above. Ahead of him are the doors of a large building. But everywhere looks the same now. Everywhere is a repeating desolation of darkness and rain and rubble. His sensoria detect movement. He slides into hiding and awaits the next encounter. They scramble to find cover. There was an alarming note of fear in Acte's warning. The only possible hiding places are the vacant alcoves, the ornate recesses where giant sentinels once stood. They crowd into the shadows of three of them, pressing in behind the elaborate frames. A procession passes down the hall. Soldiers of the Haut Palatine, in ceremonial regalia, march in, streaming, as it seems to all, from nowhere. They are escorting what looks like a column of prisoners, men and women in simple cream robes. These prisoners appear scared, or at least apprehensive, and the stink of psychanic power wafts from them. There are over 200 of them. Behind them come two cowled figures in green robes, conversing in low voices. Behind them, two terrifying custodians in gold, bearing Castellan axes of immense size. In one of the alcoves with Acte and Cat, Ol tries to squeeze himself against the wall and remain hidden. Through the fretwork of the alcove's frame, he sees the agitated psychers herded onwards. For a second, it seems as though ghosts flutter around them, half-seen shades, but he's sure it's just a trick of the light. Then the custodians pass by, and he shrinks in even more tightly, for they are beautiful and dreadful both at once. It takes a long time for the procession to disappear into the next chamber. They hear doors close. Ol peeks out. The hall is empty again.
"Psychus," he murmurs.
"Submitting to sacrifice," Acte says.
"What do you mean?"
"It wasn't clear. Their minds were clouded by something. But the figures in green, they were two of the Sigilites chosen. I could hear some of their thoughts. This is the fifth recruitment today. They are gathering the psychoactive, tithing them, as a safeguard of some kind. Something called sigil, an unspoken sanction. Taking them to the throne room to..."
"What?" asks Ol.
"I saw their thoughts, Alanius," says Acte.
She turns her blindfold face towards him.
"The Chosen were just as scared as the reinforcements they had conscripted. They're not sure what's going on, but the Emperor has risen from the throne and has engaged upon some sudden new plan."
"What do you mean, plan?"
"I don't know," says Acte.
"She doesn't," says Cat.
"And they didn't know either.